asked our first bid, who's a surgeon. And there were many of you who weren't here 2 weeks ago. Some of you briefly recall that the sturgeon became a flag issue in Hungary around the beginning of the 19th century, and it became basically a sign of whether you were or were not a religious Jew, depending upon whether you would or would not eat the sturgeon. And the prehistory of this, well, is that we have some differences of opinion as to whether the sturgeon is or is not a kosher fish, going all the way back to the time of the Olamoy, who was a writer in Girona, Spain, in the end of the beginning of the 14th century or the end of the 13th century, and he quotes explicitly that the Ramban allowed the use of this fish because he tested it by boiling fish in water, and some of the scales came off. Then we skipped about six centuries and got up to the time of the Nodal Yehuda.
If he didn't boil it, then you wouldn't have noticed the scales.
No, the scales were there. The issue is, do they come off? The scales of the sturgeon are different from the scales of most bony fishes in that they were known as ganoid scales. They're of a slightly different consistency. They're not overlapping, so this.
What's the difference if they come off or not come off?
Yes, well, the difference is that the Ramban, in his Perush on the Torah, when Rashi said the difference between what is a snapir and what is a kaskeset, in both, Rashi mentions that the snapir is the fin, which is the appendage that the fish swims with, and the kaskasim are those things which are fixed in the skin. And Ramban, in commenting upon Rashi, says it's true that the kaskeset is fixed in comparison with the snapir, but it's not all that fixed, in the sense that you have to be able to remove it either by hand or with a utensil. So this was and he brought various linguistic arguments in favor of the fact that a scale, by definition, is something which can be taken off, scaled off of the fish. So we had, on the one hand, Ramban, in his Perush on the Torah, requiring that the scales be removable. And on the other hand, you had Ramban's ruling that the sturgeon was, in fact, a kosher fish because he removed it by boiling the fish and the scales came off. And the Noda Yehuda, on his own, argued that the sterlet, that was the fish that came before him, was a kosher fish because he soaked this fish in lye, in warm water and lye for several hours, and then was able to remove the scales. And then he argued that normally we don't take an interpretation, an exegesis on the Chumash as a basis for a halakhic ruling, but what can I do? The Ramban, it's not just anybody who made this Perush, it was the Ramban, and the Beit Yosef brings the Ramban, and the Ramah brings the Ramban, so we have to bow our heads and listen to them, but we don't have to go so far as to exclude the possibility of removing the scales by some slightly extraordinary means, either by boiling or by peeling. At any event, there were those rabbis in Hungary who had there's some mixed tradition on this, and this, for some reason or other, it's not clear to me which was the cart and which is the horse here, became a flag issue, because one of the Noda Yehuda's students, who became a rabbi in Arad, apparently was faced with the problem that some of the members of this community were eating the fish and some members of the community were not eating the fish, and he ruled, following the Noda Yehuda's ruling, that this fish was kosher. And this outraged the rabbi in Fox, who claimed that, in fact, the Noda Yehuda changed his mind and told him, that is, the rabbi Fox, to let it be known that this was a non-kosher fish. And then we read, and I'll reread it for those of you who weren't here last time, only portions of the response of the son of the Noda Yehuda to this rabbi, Research and Box. So this is Top Cook Moon Head Lamp. So that's 1798. Mr. Bohana Inigiani, I received your letter. This is in response to Rabbi Fox. Some of you may still have this from 2 weeks ago, some of you may not. You've asked me to get mixed up into a dispute. But since this matter deals with a decision, since this matter refers to a decision that my father made, I cannot refrain from answering you, sir. That's what Kodma Alato means, sir. Mikabel Ratsukpo had taken Shivata Din Dali Aviha Rabiha Gaonza. I'm sending you a copy of my father's tshuva, Asher Yerashmi Nehi Ma'alato, that you requested from me. Vasher Tehakti Miseka Nodabi Uda Mahadurat Nina. This is from, I'm reading some of the tshuva here. I copied from the book, Nodabi Uda, volume 2. Asher Heniach Achra Brachat Kroda Lumi Fabi Mori Rabi Hagaon Zekra Tzifano Rabacha. Vohu Machzik, this contains Kol HaTshuvot Shehishim LaShololim Achra Had Pasat Nodabe Yehuda Maduak Kam. These contain all of the responses that my father wrote after the publication for the first edition of this response. In Mitocho Yirem Alatol, Shadoni Adi Mori Rabi Hagaon Zal, he tear dug Zeh, and you will see from this response that my father permitted this particular fish. Shasha'ala ha'arav nitula halakha. Shekol dad, shekias kasav, niklafim mena'o, alidei shviya b'mei eter, shekorin loy. Any fish whose scales can be removed after soaking in lye, o alidei ku'ula acheret, or by any other means, shakir nikvahim haskasim u'taho. That was the decision of my father. But tamei ani, and I am shocked, Shekatav ma'alato, that your honor wrote, Shadoni Ali Horig Rabbi Hagaon Zal Hadar Bo Mehora Azu. I'm shocked you say that my father changed his mind on this matter. The Tziva al ma'alato l'shloach Igeret Tahadrana la'arav nitu. Well, and he asked you to write a letter to the rabbi who we originally responded to permitting this thing. Imcholi ma'alato, forgive me, sir. Shadavag zeh sheker muchlat. This is an absolute lie. The yadua lakol, that everyone knows godel tzidkato shel adoni avi mori rabbi hagaon zal. Everyone knows how much of a tzaddik my father was. V'hayam ahir v'zariz v'malachat akiva, and he wrote very fluently. V'lama lo katav v'atzmo l'harav mitu, shahayam akiro, v'hayam eochle shulchano, shadoni mori rabbi hagaon zal. He had, in fact, changed his mind. He would have immediately written to his previous correspondent, who happened to have been a regular guest in his house. And he certainly wouldn't have relied on you to be his messenger to write to that particular rabbi. He certainly would not have hesitated to write by express mail to the Yamapaham's flying camel, but today overnight express. He certainly wouldn't have left this matter hanging had he changed his mind. And how would he have left his tshuva, which permitted this fish to be published in the second edition of his book, and would did not take the trouble to either erase this tshuva or let go the tzidosha chazarva. It's obvious that you're not to be believed in this matter. You can't produce a copy of the letter that my father supposedly wrote to you. And you tell me that you sent this letter to that rabbi and got lost. גם למה לא מודיע הרב ביטוב רבים לעשור הדר כזה? כל זה הוא למופת שכל מעלתו שקר פנה בשם אדוני אבי רבי הגאון. So it's quite clear that he was upset by someone claiming that his father
had a bluffing.
Right. If we look at the second page near the bottom, ומה שכתב מעלתו בשם שמש זקה שהביא חולקים על הרמב"ן בדג השטוריון, מזה נדבר אחר כך. וכעת אני אומר, and now I'm going to say, שמה שדימה מעלתו שהדג שטר, the fish that's called the sterlet, שהתיר הרב מערד, הוא הנקרא בלשון מתאים אשטריון, that's the same as the sturgeon, לא כך הוא. That's not exactly true, that's not correct. ואני חפשתי בספר חכמי הטבע, I searched in the biology books, וראיתי בספר אחד שחיבר רופא יהודי מתושבי כפיות אלישע ברלין, that a Jewish doctor wrote in Berlin, אשר שם מצוירים כל מיני דגים קטן וגדול, השם מצוירים במראיהם ותבניתם בגוונים שונים, כפי שהם בחייהם, one with clear pictures of these specimens, ושם נרשם כל דבע הדברים and the description of these various fish ומקום מוצאיהם ושמותם אשר נקראו עלי אדמות and the names that these fish have in various languages עם ועם כלשונם וכתבה ושם ראיתי כי הדג הסטריון the fish which is called the sturgeon נקרא בלשון מתאים שטוריה ובלשון איטליה שטורינה שטוריאנה ובלשון צרפת אסטוריון ובלשון דייץ' שטור, it's a misprint, it should be above, not a moon there, ובלשון הונגרן קצ'גי, I don't know that word in Hungarian, קצ'גי,
it's a kind of fish.
A sturgeon. Well, it's a sturgeon. והדג הזה, בעודו בקטנותו, קודם שהגיע לשנה, when it's less than a year old, נקרא באיטליה, פרצלטה. והוא הנזכר בספר שמש בפרקה שנקרא לו הרב הגדול מעכשיו. והדג הזה, this fish, מתגדל הרבה, grows to be quite large, עד שמגיע למשקל 150 ליטר, to reach 350 pounds. בצורת זה הדג, and the shape of this fish, שיש לו בליטות רחבים מלמטה וחדים מלמעלה, ויש לו שורה אחת מנותו בליטות על גבו, that has the things along the upper back, these kinds of spiny scales. ושורה אחת בכל צד, ופיו יש לו תחת גרונו בתונת צינור. And it has a mouth which is like a pipe underneath the base of the head. You saw, I just gave you pictures of this last time. אמנם השטרל, that means the sterlet, הוא דג אחר, והוא הנקרא שטרלט, ולשון ניתן רוטנס, that's presumably Ruthenian, that is, accipenser Ruthenus. Ruthenian is the name, is a way of calling Ukrainian, I mean, that's the language Ruthenian, and the Latin name of the Sterlet is accipenser, which is a generic name of all of these fish, the Sterlet and so forth, Ruthenus, and it was because it was a common fish of Ukraine. וזה אינו גדול כל כך. That doesn't go to be so large. כי לכל היותר אמה וחצי, it only gets to be a foot and a half long, ומשקלו לכל היותר יודז ניתות. It doesn't exceed 12 pounds in weight. הרי מבואר חוסרי חכמי הטבע שזה השטרל אינו השטריון ושם מינים אין. והנה הדג טיק שהתיר איש מבואו פעל התל מתלונן עליו לא אוכל לדבר דבר כי לא ראיתי דג זה מעולם ולא ידעתי מה הוא. And I also don't know what this fish tick is, and apparently your correspondence in Hungary as well. And now let me just simply the last paragraph. Kalalo shel davar, ani ro'eh she'malato ba l'klal midat ha'nitzuach. It seems to me that he's just gotten into a big fight. And we call it chaos, and because of anger, ba l'klal ta'ur. ובלי דעת מדבר דברים הסותרים זה את זה, ועל יתר דברי מעלתו שהם רק ויכוח ונשיבו לו אשיב דבר. ואני לא באתי כי אם להצדיק הצדיק במקרא, I only came to justify my father, The Onzal Hashem Alatome is that you have the nerve with Chotzbarav Bekash to simply reject these things with the statements with the straw. And reject his arguments like he was a student for one day. And so on. And then he proceeds to berate his correspondent. So this was the response we learned last time of the son of the murderer. We also saw.
Didn't they sow in those days? Yeah, we should have sown.
That's pretty strong language. You don't normally find this language. Where?
Yeah.
In Prague. He was the chief rabbi of Prague. For many years. He was the famous chief rabbi of Prague in the second half of the 18th century. We discussed him in great detail in his biography last time. But we saw that Rabbi Bannett, the chief rabbi of Moravia, did not allow this fish. And rather, to my mind, weak reasons, claiming that all that we know from the testimony that the Ramban allowed such a fish was that he boiled it and he found some scales, indicating that if you boil it and the scales form off by themselves, then they count as scales. But if you have to peel them off after boiling, then they don't count as scales. So there's no evidence whatsoever to support that position. But this, as I said, this became a flag issue in Hungary. And it divided the so-called Orthodox from the so-called status quo, and certainly from the Neologues over the next century and a half. I distributed a tshuva of the Ketav Sofer, who was the son of the Ketav Sofer, who basically reiterates the position of Rabbi Bannett prohibiting this fish. His arguments aren't any more convincing to me, at least, than Rabbi Bannett's position. I now want to move from Hungary to Galicia. And I want to read a tshuva of a man who was certainly the leading posek in the whole world at the end of the 19th century, and that's Rabbi Shaul Mordechai Shvadron, the Maharsham, who lived in a small town in Galicia and who was deciding questions from all over the world. Towards the end of his life, he would get something like 10 or more tshuvot a day, and he would answer each of them on the spot. So he was sort of regarded. He was known as the Gezanerov because he lived in a small town called, in Yiddish literature, Gezan, or Berezani, in Ukraine. But maybe we should say a few words about Galicia altogether. We knew a little bit about the history of the country. So I did several things. I hope I have enough. So here's a batch, and I hope I have to go around. I Xeroxed an article on Galicia, first from the Encyclopedia Britannica of around 1910 or 1911. So this was still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that time. I need one. Okay, so first of all, you should remember that the prehistory, Galicia, existed. Galicia existed as an entity from 1772 to 1918. That is, prior to 1772, Galicia was part of Greater Poland. And Poland was gradually nibbled away by the various surrounding powers in the second third of the 18th century. And by 1772, Poland disappeared as a state because it was broken up into three pieces. One piece, including Posen, went to Prussia. Another piece went to Russia, and the third piece went to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the portion of Poland which went to the Austro-Hungarian Empire was called Galicia. And the Jews in Greater Poland had exercised an enormous amount of community control and autonomy, the Ba'ad al-Ba'ad al-Tzot, and so on, from the middle of the 15th, or the end of the 15th, certainly the middle of the 16th century, up until shortly before the partition of Poland. And when Austria annexed Galicia, these three communities became quite separated, and each one developed its own separate characteristics. So first, let's just simply read what it says, how this place was described in the Encyclopedia Britannica from around 1911. That is before World War I, before the disintegration of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Because the acquisition of Galicia was certainly, and the decisions that Joseph II made around the time of this conquest eventually led to the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And I'll mention several of them. One of them was that he wanted to modernize the administration. So he had this vast empire consisting of many different lands, Hungary, Bohemia, Moravia, and so on. And the administration was, of course, carried out in Latin. So Latin is a dead language. And one of the modernizing steps was to replace Latin by German. But of course, in replacing Latin by German, all hell broke out for the very simple reason that now those who were native German speakers had the decided advantage over any of the others. If you wanted to go into the administration previously, whether you were Bohemian or Hungarian or Czech or Slavic, you had to learn Latin. Now, it was true that he replaced the dead language by a live language and therefore intended to modernize the administration, but the net effect was to cause a huge amount of resentment for all of those nationalities which were within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for which German was not the native language. So the Hungarians developed a movement to have Magyar, have Hungarian be the correct language, and the Czechs wanted to have Czech being the native language, and so on. So that led to ethnic, linguistic nationalism, which in the course of a century and a half led to this integration of the empire, the law of unintended consequences. Okay, so let's read what the situation was like in this is a non-Jewish, and I'll now read it from the Jewish Encyclopedia Judaica. A crown land of Austria, bounded on the east and the north by Russia, on the south by Bukovina and Hungary, and on the west by Austria and Prussian Silesia. I xeroxed a map, so if you look on the third page, you can see where Galicia is. That's sort of the top-shaded region, with Bukovina to the southeast, and Bessarabia, and Moldova, and Hungary all along the south. And the boundary between Hungary and Galicia being the Carpathian Mountains. Okay? Galicia lies on the northern slope of, it comprises all the old kingdoms of Galicia and Lubomira, the duchies of Auschwitz and Zatar, and the Grand Duchy of Krakow. Galicia lies on the northern slopes of the Carpathians, which with their offshoots cover about a third of the whole area of the country. The surface gradually sinks down by undulating terraces to the valleys in the Vistula and the Dniester. To the north and east of these rivers, Galicia forms a continuation of the great plains of Russia, intersected only by a few hills, which descend from the plateaus of Poland and Podolia, which attain in some places an altitude of 1,300 to 1,500 feet. The Carpathians, which extend in the form of an arc, form the boundary between Galicia and Hungary, are divided to the west and the east, etc. Let's skip about that. Down to the bottom, we'll go to the next page. You can read more of the details on your own. I don't really have to read that. The manufacturing industries of Galicia are not highly developed. Well, that's an understatement. One of the ideas of Maria Theresa and her son was to use Galicia as sort of a colony of the rest of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so they should export the manufactured goods to Galicia and treat that as just a place where there were no industries. So the manufacturing industries of Galicia are not highly developed. The first place is occupied by the distilleries, whose output amounts to nearly 40% of the total production of the spirits in Austria. Then follow the petroleum refineries and the kindred industries, sawmills, and the fabrication of various wood articles, papers, and milling. The sugar factory at Lamaze and the tobacco factory at Linnike are amongst the largest establishments of their kind in Austria. Cloth manufacture is concentrated at Biala, while the weaving of linen and woolens is pursued as a household industry, the former in the Carpathian region, the latter in Eastern Greece. The commerce, which is mainly in the hands of Jews, is very active, and the transit trade to Russia and to the East is also of considerable importance. Galicia had in 1900 a population of 7,295,000, etc., which is equivalent to 241 inhabitants per square mile. The two principal nationalities are the Poles and the Ruthenians. Ruthenians means Ukrainians. The former predominating in the west and in the big towns, and the latter in the east. The Poles who inhabit the Carpathians are distinguished from the Goralians or in Gori Mountain, and those of the lower regions as Mazurs and Kosoviaks. The Poles are mostly Roman Catholic, the Ruthenians are Greek Catholics, and there are over 770,000 Jews and about 20,000 Armenians who are Catholics and stand under the jurisdiction of the Armenian Archbishop. Okay, however, there are quite a number of cities and towns in Galicia, which at the time had not a Jewish majority, a substantial Jewish minority, and the small towns, especially the towns we're going to want to look at, were almost entirely Jewish. So now, I put a little black dot near in this map near Rezani. Okay, that's the town at which the Marsham eventually ended up as the rabbi. He was known as the Rezani Rav. You can see if you look at the next map with the Xerox machine, you can do some enlargements. I enlarged this. And if you look at the next map, you will see that Rezani was a tiny little town along the river, and that's very important because the river was the mode of trade and transport down to Turkey and Russia, which was the nearest big town was Tarnopol, and the other large town, not all that far away, was Lemberg, which is, of course, Lvov in Polish and Lviv in Ukrainian. Now, if you go along the river towards the east from Rezani until you hit the next river, and then you go down to the next intersection of rivers, you see the smaller town of Bukach. And the
Bukach is right here.
So we're here is Bukach.
Bukach.
Yes, a lot of famous people were born in Buchach. For example, the Shmuel Yosef Tashkes, who's the only person, Jewish author, who won the Nobel Prize in literature, was unknown. This is pen name.
Freud's grandfather.
And Freud's grandfather was born in Buchach. And I think Freud's father was also there. They moved to Vienna from Buchach. Okay.
Something in the air.
Okay. Now, I had some other handout here, but I'm not going to this.
Just curious, what would be your guess as to the formulation of the
10,000?
Mostly Jews.
No. Here's, as I said, Rabbi Schwadron. Was served as a rabbi in various different towns. The last town, which is known as the Razan Rav, was Razan. But his position prior to that, from about 1875 to 1881, was Buchach. And he was about 40 when he accepted that position. Here's some information about Buchach. So we can know what we're talking about. Okay. Woodchurch was founded in the 14th century, and the following historical description of Woodchurch and its Jewish community is derived from Pinchas of Gehillot, etc. Following the Turkish wars, the Gehillot prospered. What affects us is Woodchurch in Austria and Galicia. With the partition of Poland in 1772, Woodchurch came under Austrian rule. No longer did the Jews of Woodchurch benefit from the protection of just living in the surrounding villages unless they were directly engaged in agriculture. Well, taxes were increased substantially, including taxes on candles, marriage, and kosher slaughter. Taxes on candles is an absolute outrage. Every Jew had to pay a tax on the Shabbat candles, and every Jew had to buy Shabbat candles for Shabbat. This was something introduced by... There's an excellent book on one aspect of what was happening in Galicia, which is a book by Rafael Mahler called Hasidism and the Jewish Enlightenment. And this describes the role of the Maskilim and the Hasidim in Buchach, in Galicia, excuse me. Galicia itself, of course, had, like Hungary, but in a much different sense, three components. One had the original Jewish communities, the rabbinical communities, in other words, people who eventually became known as the Misnagdim. And then you had the influx of Hasidim, who eventually took over most of the of Galician communities. And then you had the Maskilim, and many of the leaders of the Haskalah movement in Eastern Europe were, in fact, in Galicia. We only mentioned people like Joseph Pearl and others. And they were quite vicious, some of them, Pearl in particular. So here you have a Marxist historian, that is, a person who writes his history from the perspective of economic materialism, on the one hand, but I'm showing how the Maskilim, who in their desire to benefit the Jewish community, would not hesitate to use all kinds of vicious means, including keeping people over to the Galician, to the Austrian government, and so on. It's a fascinating book, and it's well worthwhile. Another interesting book, which I've mentioned before, is a survey of the Jews, of the Habsburg Jews. That's written by a non-Jew, in fact, doesn't even read Hebrew or Yiddish, but and he is emphasizing more the Jews who left the Jewish community. I mean, what he wants to know was, why was it that during all of this time that all various different nationalities were converging, that the Jews wanted to become enlightened and become part of the general either German or Hungarian culture instead of establishing their own nationalism? Of course, they did later in the form of Zionism, which also was based in no small part in Galicia. At any rate, if we take a look, let's read the page, Religious Patterns. From the early 18th century, the religious and cultural fabric of Galician Jewry was buffeted and torn by the rival beliefs of Hasidism, Mitnagdim, and the Haskalah. Hasidism swept in Galicia from Podolia and Volnia, winning over large numbers, perhaps a majority of the region's Jews. Exhibiting the characteristics of a pious folk religion, Hasidism captured profoundly the religiosity of the populace, subjugated by rabbinic legalism and poverty. Each center of Hasidism evolved around its Rebbe, a charismatic and mystical rabbinical intermediary to God, who defined and shaped the spiritual traits, customs, and behavioral attributes of this particular sect. Opposing Hasidism were those Jews rooted in the traditional scholasticism and legalism associated with religious orthodoxy. For Mitnagdim, literally opponents of Hasidism, authentic Judaism demanded strict adherence to rabbinic authority manifested through Talmudic scholarship. To these Mitnagdim, Hasidim were heretics. Religious and communal conflicts between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim were heated and intense. Despite differences of the doctrine and of the leadership, Hasidim and Mitnagdim alike remained unalterably committed to the meticulous observance of Orthodox beliefs, values, rituals, and identity. Acculturation into the secular, inherently Gentile culture surrounding them was firmly rejected, and so on. Like other Jewish settlements in Galicia, the Jews of the 19th century Bukach were divided as between Hasidim, Mitnagdim, and Maskilim. Yet, by way of contrast with many other towns and shtetls in Bukach, relations among the three groupings remained cordial. No religious culture camp ensued among the Jews of Bukach. By the middle of the 19th century, there were 12 official houses of worship in Buchach, including the Great Synagogue, two Bate Medrash, two Hasidic cloisters, and prayer houses for particular occupation groups. In addition, there were about 10 in Yonim and private houses. Hasidism came to Buchach through Rabbi Aram David Bar Asher Anchel Barman, who assumed the rabbinical post in 1813. And maybe I should read a brief biography of Rabbi Warman, because he's mentioned in the tshuva if we want to study. Rabbi Avraham David was born in Nagorno, Galicia. His first teacher was his father, Rabbi Asher Anchel, who was known as Warman, because of his personal character. In addition to Torah, Rabbi Asher Anchel taught his son arithmetic, German, and Polish. That's pretty sharp. Young Avraham David was a dedicated student, and already at age 6, he was seen reviewing his Torah lessons, and this is a typical hagiography. At age 10, the future of Avraham David became engaged to the daughter of the Shlich Hirsch Kora of Buchach, and he moved to that town to study under his future father. After his marriage, Avraham David became known throughout Buchach not only for his expertise on most branches of the Torah knowledge, but also by his acts, which he performed in a low-key and humble manner. Beginning in 1791, Avraham David served as rabbi of Yaspelwitz for 24 years. In that small town, he was able to study, and so on and so forth. In 1814, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kora died, and Rav Dom David was offered the rabbinate of Buchach in his place. Rav Dom David accepted, and it is as the rabbi of Buchach that Rav Dom is best known, and it was here that he spent the remainder of his days until his passing in the second day of Chodesh Cheshvan, and that's in 1840. So he was the rabbi of Buchach from 1814 to 1840. Rabbi Avraham David was a prolific author. His best known works are Da'at Kedoshim and Parts of the Shulchan Aruch Yerodea and Eshel Avraham and Shulchan Aruch Chai. The latter work was printed in the back of standard edition of the Shulchan Aruch. So he was the rabbi of Buchach until 1840, and like the Yankees, we hired the number of Bay Ruth so that nobody can have a 3 exactly correct number on his uniform. The next rabbanim who came to Buchach were not given the title of Rav. They were Av Bezbin, but out of honor to the preceding rabbi. So when the Marsham became the rabbi of Buchach in 1875, he was officially the Av Bezbin, but not the Rav Av Bezbin of Buchach. Who?
Marsham.
He was a Hasid. Yes, that is, he had a strong relation with the various Hasidic rebbeim. You have to understand that, for example, it was a big revolution at the beginning of the 20th century to institute the concept of a yeshiva in Galicia. The notion of a yeshiva existed in Lithuania, as created by the students of the Vilna Gaon, as a counterweight to Hasidism and Haskalah. And of course, in Hungary, you had the great yeshiva of Hassan Soker and then various others. Originally,
no Korean.
No. now the Reform have Korean. One has to understand that Hasidim were opposed to yeshivas, because remember the idea of a chassid is that the head of the community is a charismatic figure, and he does not want a competing charismatic figure. I think it's safe to say that by today, originally the nature of the charisma of being a Rosh Yeshiva was somewhat different from the nature of the charisma of being a Hasidic Rebbe. I doubt there's any difference. That is, the concept of being a local rabbi and having your greatness and your authority established by your position as the rabbi of the community was something that gradually disappeared in the course of the 19th century. The Hasidim certainly regarded the local rabbi or the Abbezdin as a technical official, right? I mean, he wasn't the mayor of the town, he was some assistant district attorney or something, someone who had to settle halachic issues, but who did not exercise charisma. The Hassam Sofer certainly exercised charisma, both as being the rabbi in Pressburg and also as being the head of a large yeshiva. In Lithuania, Vitzko Hanan, of course, was a great rabbi, but most of the charisma was associated with the Russian yeshiva. Today, a rabbi of the community or a rabbi of the town doesn't have that. It's being either the Rosh Yeshiva, which exercises a certain amount of personal charisma, or being a Rebbe, which exercises a large amount of personal charisma. And the reasons are somewhat similar because their ideas are no longer subjected to criticism, right? If you were a Rav and you're someone like the Nevi Yehuda and you wrote a Tshuva, people would read it and agree or disagree. We'll see that the Masham had his people who not always agreed with him. Mostly Hungarians, but we'll come to that later. Only at the beginning of the 20th century were the rabbis in Galicia and the rabbis in Galicia realized that probably it's a good idea to establish this institution of the yeshiva, and at that time the Masham, over his reluctance, participated.
How come you don't mention the Rebbe, the Rabbi Baal Shem Tov?
Baal Shem Tov? That was a century earlier. He was at the end of the 18th century.
He started the Hasidic movement in Hungary and other places.
No, he started in the Ukraine, but obviously,
yes.
We're now talking about three generations later. After the Hasidic movement had been really established by his student, and then one or two generations after that. So the Baal Shem Tov was someone who lived 100 years before the period, who died 100 years before the time that we're talking about now. We're talking now in the middle of the end of the, middle of the 18th century.
Well, if you would know the shiver that would bear, what happened to the young men?
They studied with a local rabbi, or with a rabbi, or on their own. Rabbis. After his marriage, he engaged in business, mainly in the timber trade, but in 1866, he lost his fortune. That was due to the end of the Prussian-Austrian War. Although offered important positions, he steadfastly refused to accept them, contenting himself with a rabbi in a small community. The first was Potok, but he finally became Rabbi of Dresden and was henceforth known as the Rabbi of Dresden or the Marshal, from the title of his volume of response. His fame was much greater than the positions he held. He exercised firm control and civil authorities used to transfer to him cases in which Jews were involved. In other words, cases that normally would appear before the civil court would normally be transferred to him. And one of his great loves was, what he felt was a great duty, was to act as a judge. His earliest work was in Shvat Shalom, in which he dealt with various issues of civil law for Kosher Mishpat, and he used to always take many, many cases and was able to resolve them in relatively short order.
And this happened was because the civil authorities respected
him. They respected him enormously. He was a man of great scholarship and also a very pleasant person. He was recognized as he was certainly recognized by the local Austrian authorities as a great man, a scholar, and he also had a very modest, or I would say warm, temper. He used to go out and feed the birds every morning and not threaten them. Consulted by some of the greatest scholars, he always used to answer his questions